Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know, but all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full-spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show,
I often find that heartbreak is sometimes the best motivator for change, because you're really in like a primal emotional pain. So when someone's sort of heartbreak is greater than the situation that happened, it's really not about them. It's about mom or dad. It's about that primal attachment wound. your relationship has nothing to do with the other person. It's all about you and the way you relate to the other person. And basically, we have templates that are created by the way we're raised and the way our brain is wired that cause us to be in functional or dysfunctional relationships.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power, speed, mobility, balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
My lips, I have just been informed, are still blue from either this morning's crazy pool workout up at Laird Hamilton and Gabby Reese's house in Malibu, or possibly from the surfing we just did outside my guest's house. He's sitting right here with me. His name, as you've just learned, is Neil Strauss, and he's a lot more than just a book writer. Or an author, I guess we should say. That's probably a little bit more smooth than book writer. Neil, how you doing?
Good, man. Yeah, we had it's a 7-hour journey to doing this podcast.
We started
7 hours ago, I think.
It's hard to get done in Malibu. We woke up this morning. We went and did the pool workout.
Right, which was intense.
So for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, Neil, describe the pool workout to me.
So Laird Hamilton, the incredible big wave surfer,
like does 100-foot waves around the world,
and so much more. Kind of developed this pool workout where you're lifting and swimming with weights in the water, and so you might grab 2 40-pound weights, sink to the bottom of the pool. You'll walk, and a lot of it's about sort of seeing how long you can hold your breath, and really playing with breathing and oxygenation.
Don't try this alone at home.
Don't try it alone at home. Right. We've had people literally black out in the pool and hit their forehead on the side.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know this. I'm glad you didn't tell me this before we started.
And we did something pretty hardcore today.
Well, so just to give you an example, and I just uploaded a video of Neil to the Snapchat page over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Snapchat, where you can watch him going back and forth across the pool. You probably held your breath for almost 2 minutes, I'd say.
And it's not really just holding how long you can hold your breath. It's because the workout itself and the energy you put in use a lot of oxygen. The harder you're working, the harder it is to hold your breath.
Right. So for example, you grab the 2 40-pound dumbbells, you walk them across the bottom of the pool all the way to one end, and then you grab the other one, you held it to your chest.
And then you swim back up to the surface on the other side.
To the surface, but you don't come up for a breath. Because then you go back across with that same dumbbell, you go back across, grab the lone dumbbell that you left at the other edge, and then run that back.
Right. And the crazy thing is, when I was first told about this, I literally did not think it was possible. And it's mental more than physical. It's mental. And it's knowing that when you're feel like you're out of air and your body's, it's just your body's warning signal. You still have a lot of oxygen left.
I learned this when I took a free diving course, when your diaphragm, so you know that feeling, if you're listening, you've probably kind of heard this before. If you do any amount of underwater work, it's kind of like, like your diaphragm starts to contract and you feel that and you just keep going.
Yeah. And you can learn to do little things, little like tricks, such as I'll just exhale a little bit when I really feel like I'm running out of air, and that'll just allow me to go a little bit further.
Right. And then another example that Neil showed me is you basically do, what are they called, seahorses?
Yeah.
So you have a dumbbell basically up by your crotch. You're holding an 8.
Holding it between your legs.
Or a 10 or a 15 between your legs, and you're treading water. Your feet are up in a V shape. And tell folks about that workout that we did this morning after we did what you just described.
So what you want is you're sort of facing forward with your, you want your
you want your entire feet out of the water, and you're propelling yourself forward, so your body's in a V shape, you're just propelling yourself across the water.
With your hands.
With your hands, feet out of the water, and your head can be out of the water or underwater, it doesn't matter. You go to the other side, 10 push-ups, hop back in, go across again, 10 push-ups, and after maybe 6 of these, just your arms are so gone, just pulling yourself out of the water is brutal.
Yeah, I mean, dude, I played water polo where we would have people like standing on the edge of the pool, dropping a medicine ball. You're treading water, you're throwing the medicine ball back up, right, without using your hand. So it's all egg beater kick with the legs. We did those type of sprints where you'd sprint across the pool and get out and do push-ups. But we never did this kind of stuff where you're actually going back and forth under the water.
It's amazing.
With
what's
the dumbbells.
What's so amazing is that Laird is literally inventing a new workout. And you and I are getting to sort of experience this new workout being invented in front of our eyes, because every time you come back into town, there's a new exercise we're doing. It's got a new name, and it's amazing to sort of be on the ground floor of this. And it intuitively just feels good in your body. You're in the water. You're outside in the sun. You're not working just with strength. You're working with oxygen, with movement. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's a full body and full mind routine. And then the other thing is there's a barrel sauna and an ice tub. Tell me about what you do with the barrel sauna and the ice tub that are right next to the pool.
So when you're done, it's the sauna, which is about 220 degrees. You do the sauna for about 15 minutes, and then you do the ice for 3 minutes. And it's funny because people at that workout have the personality that as soon as you can't really say, hey, look at what I did, because as soon as you say, look at what I did, someone will say, oh, do it this way. So maybe you're in the ice bath and you say, hey, I just did 5 minutes, and then Laird or someone will say, oh, do it with your hands underwater.
Right.
Someone else will say, well, I did it fully submerged for a minute underwater in the ice tub. So every time you think you're getting good, they're getting better.
So you've got heat, cold, breath, strength, in the water, out of the water, so many components that you work. And you do this how many days a week, Neil?
3 days a week.
Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday?
Yeah.
You go in there, and we were there, we showed up at like 8:30, and we were there till almost 11.
Yeah,
just basically going back and forth. So we delved down this rabbit hole when you were saying it took 7 hours for us to podcast, but bear with us, because then we went to Sun Life Organics in Malibu, and had
home of the most expensive smoothie in America.
Okay, so I've got the ingredients pulled up here in front of me. This is called the $1 billion smoothie. For those of you who want to replicate this at home, it is. Okay, here we go. Because this was your first time drinking this as well, right?
Yeah, and this is similar to what you normally drink in the morning, right?
And it's kind of similar to what I make at home in the morning. I haven't had explosive diarrhea yet, but it's young Thai coconut meat, spinach, raw cashew butter, goat colostrum, chlorophyll, aloe, vitamin C crystals, collagen, silica, greens powder, grass-fed whey protein, E3 Live, which I think is like a brain nootropic type of thing, it's called Brain On, MCT oil, a 10 mushroom blend from our friends over at Four Sigmatic, which is like reishi and chaga and cordyceps, hemp milk. The list goes on and on, and it's what, $28.
Yeah, it's so.
You nursed yours for like 2 hours. Yeah, I punished mine in five minutes.
You had dinner with the owner last night, and he's a friend, so they gave it to us for free. But I was really thinking, like every sip is like a quarter, right?
Yeah,
you know, that's the math.
Cha-ching.
It's really hard to justify.
And then we surfed. Very very active day leading up to today's podcast, and played a little Oculus Rift. If you hear voices and shouting in the background, there's still people in Neil's gaming room / library playing. Is it HTC?
It's the HTC Vive. So what it is, the Oculus Rift is the one that's kind of been really famous, and that right now it's just the goggles. They don't have hand controllers publicly available, but they're making them pretty soon. But the HTC Vive is what they call room scale virtual reality. And they're freaking out right now.
And you can just like run around the room. What's the game he's playing right now?
So he was doing Brookhaven Experiment, which is a zombie one. And it's terrifying. When my wife did it, she literally ripped off the goggles and had tears in her eyes. It was so scary. It's so real. And they're playing maybe now Raw Data, which is a kind of a robot one.
That's crazy.
But what's cool about Room Scale is you can literally move around the room and it really feels real, and you have hand controllers you can pick up and touch.
I just took the Oculus Rift off my head, and I haven't done much virtual reality at all. It is crazy how realistic it was.
When you do it, you start to realize that this, what's happened with augmented and virtual reality, will be a revolution maybe bigger than the internet, because people are going to just walk around the world and decide what level of reality they want to be in at any time.
Is there utility for giving, because all of the listeners love to biohack their bodies or improve right. their brains. Like, how could you use something like that to actually get a better body or get a better brain?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the things, it's funny that people aren't doing that with it yet, and I would love them to do it.
Yeah.
But what I'm thinking would be amazing for people who sort of, being able to follow, I think would be able to follow the journey of the food once it's in your body and see, okay, when I'm eating this, look at where it's landing and look at what's happening.
What do you mean? Imagine
if you just showed somebody who's drinking sugary beverages like soda or something.
Right.
Imagine if you could show them the journey that Coke takes in their body and they could follow it.
Oh, see, what I was thinking was some kind of like a mentally challenging game or some kind right. of like a physically rigorous game that you could do with virtual reality.
It's funny because you definitely have to be in the right space because someone just dented my wall.
Yeah, your library is a little
trying
small.
Trying to kill a zombie.
I was in there eating a salad as this guy was playing a virtual reality game, and he literally stuck the little wand controller right in my salad. Cameron, who's in there playing right now?
Cameron Dallas,
some famous internet personality. I've just learned is a famous internet personality. I guess you could probably Google him. Internet, I don't know, heartthrob kind of guy.
Yeah, he's something just sort like of that. Instagram is his yeah. art, or Vine yeah. and Instagram. That's his art form.
Yeah.
But as far as mental things, also, I also think it would be good for sort of trauma healing, getting over phobias, mm-hmm. because you realize how fragile the mind is. Because once you go into that virtual reality and you know it's not real, it feels and looks real.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So I think we haven't sort of.
What's the most physically rigorous thing that you've done using virtual reality?
I would,
you're not allowed to say virtual sex. This is we can mark this podcast as explicit if need be. I know you've written some pretty explicit books.
You wrote the topic, but the truth is, my wife and I tried to experiment with that. It didn't really. We tested it out. It wasn't as maybe we tried the wrong thing, but it wasn't there yet. It felt like they were gigantic.
Virtual reality sex was like gigantic, pixelated.
Yeah, their perspective wasn't right. And also, like when your goggles are on, you really don't know what's around you. So you could be. You know, all your friends could be surrounding you laughing.
Or you could be humping your bookshelf.
yeah, exactly. There'd probably be some foolish videos coming out. But I would say right now it's not really a substitute for actually doing what we did today. But some of the shooter games, you're really out of breath because they're coming around.
You mean not a substitute for like an underwater pool workout?
For example.
Yeah, that's my concern is, you know, even for my kids, you know, when I was wearing the Oculus Rift in there just now with you, I thought, wow, this would be really cool for my kids, but not as cool as them actually going outside and right. you know hunting a rabbit with their bow and arrow.
Right.
Or
what I think it is.
And I'm sorry if you love rabbits. For everybody who loves rabbits, go ahead.
Cute little bunny rabbits. So what it is educational though. You can really have empathy. I think there are a lot of great videos being made in displaced persons camps in Syria, and you can really see what it's like. So what I think people are doing now is allowing you to have the experiences you want because it really feels like
interesting.
You're there. And once they have haptics is the next level. Next level of haptics is where you actually get the touch and feeling of stuff. So kind of where a lot of the kind of tech science is right now is around working with haptics. So when that dinosaur was breathing on you, you would feel the breath and the wetness.
So you wouldn't just see it. You'd actually feel it. You would wear sensors on your fingers, on your toes, anything where you wanted sensory perception.
Yeah, or a bodysuit. I was just with this isn't even what we're talking about on this podcast, but it's fascinating. I was just at a place called Two Bit Circus, where it's sort of a group of people who are working a lot with virtual reality, and they have things where maybe you're in a race car. It's kind of like the junkyard version of it in a sense. And they're doing great stuff, by the way, very advanced, but. Where you're maybe in a race car and you're in a seat that's shaking, there's a fan blowing on you, so it feels like you're really there. So that's sort of the homemade tinker version, even though they're doing advanced stuff of haptics. So people are doing really cool stuff with VR right now. And I'm really thinking with my baby, who you might have heard in the background earlier, who's 18 months old, I really think when he grows up, he's not going to want to see flat screen photos of himself. So I want to get a 360 degree camera.
So boring.
Yeah, it really like you're
photos.
Not going to eventually movies. You're going to be in them looking around in the center of the action.
Yeah.
For sporting events too.
That's nuts. I'm so torn on this because it's like I really want my kids to grow up in the woods, yeah, surviving and, you know, living with the dirt and the elements and all the negative ions that we get from the world, and not spend all their time indoors on virtual reality and you know, plugged in and getting all the blue light exposure. But at the same time, it's freaking fun, and you could see a ton of utility for learning and for gaming and for, I mean, the sky's the limit with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, even think as a writer that I would love to create the perfect writing environment to write in.
Yeah.
On that sort of.
I see what you did there. We're supposed to be talking about some of these amazing books that you've written.
We don't have to.
But what I'm curious about, actually, because you've got some, you know, I know that you're best known, and for those of you who are familiar with Neil, you're best known for this book, The Game. But you have some books that have quite a bent towards optimal brain performance and even some pretty physically rigorous activities, like, right, like Emergency, for example, which I want to ask you a little bit about. But have you always been into getting more out of your body and your brain, or were you just like a geeky journalist that eventually discovered underwater pool workouts along the way, or where did fitness and health or nutrition start to become an interest for you?
Yeah, I think there's several questions in there. So I think the first thing is, I know that life exists outside your comfort zone. So mm-hmm. Number one is, I'm always want to be outside my comfort zone. If I'm scared of something, that makes me want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of my books are about, there's maybe, if I say I can't, or there's a challenge in my life where I'm really stuck, you know, I don't write about what I know. I write about what I don't know, and maybe become an expert of it in it by the end of the book. So it's the perfect job, because you can just say, oh, I'm horrible at this. This is really a big area in my life where I feel like I'm missing out. For example, last book, The Truth, was about relationships. I was, mm-hmm. all my relationships went wrong. It was, mm-hmm. of course, always the other person's fault. So I started to realize, well, I'm the common denominator, right?
Right.
And so I really explored, like, well, what is it about relationships? And you really go deep. And you don't just talk to the experts, but you actually go through the experience. You can come out the other side with some knowledge,
yeah,
which
you can go into specifics. I can mark this podcast episode as explicit if need be, but I think that would be a fascinating way to illustrate how you do go deep. What did you do when you wrote this book, The Truth?
I started off in sex addiction rehab, and I wouldn't say that I'm a sex addict,
mm-hmm.
But I was in love, or so I thought, and I cheated on the person, and got caught, and I just thought,
you cheated
on Ingrid,
on your wife,
my wife. No,
yeah,
wife.
You were married at the time. Your wife, who's in the room next to us,
right?
Okay.
And we have no secrets. So.
Right, right. It's quite obvious. You wrote a whole book about it.
Yeah, I know exactly. No secrets.
Actually, I own this book and I read it, and I think the first page just says, "Ingrid, don't read this."
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah,
and the last page says, "Ingrid, I hope you did read this." So that's the journey from I don't want to, I have a secret life that I don't want to share with
right.
you, to I want to share all of me with you.
Mm-hmm.
So. So
you cheated on your wife. You went to sex addiction therapy.
Right. And so I just thought, I thought I was a good person, but how would a good person lie to someone they love, deceive someone they love, hurt someone they love? Like, really, what's wrong with me? And our friend you're doing a podcast with, Rick Rubin, he's mm-hmm. also in the book, really said, hey, if sex was so important to you that you're willing to hurt yourself and other people to get and lie and violate your ethics system, maybe you're a sex addict. And I said, I don't know, but what if I just... And at this point, it wasn't a book. It was just me trying to, like, figure out what was wrong with me. So I actually checked myself into sex addiction rehab. And what I found there was not a bunch of sort of perverted, you know, people you'd expect.
Right.
But other people who'd
right.
cheated on
bunch
their
of creepy
wives.
Guys with dark-colored glasses.
Yeah. In my sort of group, except for one guy, everybody was there because they had cheated on their girlfriend or wife. And it's interesting. It's just interesting that.
But you went way above. Like I read
that was
the
just
book.
The beginning.
You
that was just
over,
the first step.
You were doing
step.
Like three ways in Paris and drugged out orgies like in Europe. And like
oh, well, so yeah. That was so. I decided so, and I think this is a conversation a lot of people have that, you know, are we meant to be monogamous?
Mm-hmm.
Right. In my head, I was like, okay, like, and again, in sex addiction rehab, they had a very, very, let's say, Puritan take. They really said like you should go on something like 20 dates with someone before you have physical intimacy and make an emotional connection first, which the truth is it actually makes sense because a lot of bad, you know, it's funny that I would say that now because I was really angry about them saying it. I thought they were trying to sort of, you know, impose, you know, Victorian morality on us. But the truth is, if you really want a relationship, start with an emotional connection first and then have the physical. Because a lot of people have a great physical connection and then a disastrous relationship for years.
Yeah. Oh, I've been married for almost 14 years now. Right. And my entire relationship with my wife started off as us being really, really good friends.
Right.
For a year and a half before we had any romantic relationship, before we fell in love, we just adventured together.
Yeah.
And there was a huge emotional component.
Yeah.
Which means as we get old and really ugly and have horrible bodies and everything else that people might associate with bad sex or whatever, it's really not going to matter because there's so many things in the relationship that go beyond that.
You really got to look at the person and say, I'm going to love you.
Right.
Whatever we become and whatever happens to us and whatever we look like.
You take a deep dive when you write these books. You're definitely the quintessential immersive journalist.
So the question I asked myself, I just cut you off, I realized,
right.
but the question I asked myself was, if you look at science, there's nothing in science that says monogamy is natural.
Mm-hmm.
Even the species that one thought were monogamous before, they discover that not all their litter or their offspring have the same, the DNA test doesn't match to the father. So they're sneaking around behind their back. They might be so
even
they
like found the what's the fox, the swan is the swan a monogamous?
I think the swan was one that was thought to be monogamous. I don't remember that.
But then they found out that the daddy swans were actually out.
And that was true with the fox. The one
messing around.
And again, I know you like to get scientific, so we'll do this. So the one, the animal they love to study is the vole. Do you know about this?
It's funny because the voles have come up on the show before. The voles, when I interviewed Dr. David Minkoff about cancer, he got into how the voles near Chernobyl in Russia live for an inordinate amount of time. Somehow radiation has allowed them to have some kind of like an anti-aging longevity effect in their mitochondria. But you found something else about the voles.
Yeah,
and
so there are two kinds of voles, and I'm just going off my memory, so I'm going to get this slightly wrong about which kinds. There's like the prairie vole and the other vole. I don't know, we'll call it the city vole.
Make it up, and I would not be able
to call
you out.
The city vole, but it's not the prairie vole. It's another type of vole. And one vole, it is like monogamous and mates for life.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a player, right? Just plays the field.
Right.
Literally, right? And they sort of discovered that those who are naturally monogamous have a gene coding for a longer vasopressin receptor. So when I found this out, I thought, okay, I went to this guy, Hasse Wallum, who'd done a lot of the studies. He was in Sweden, and he'd also been at Emory when they did this study, and he's one of the biggest guys studying the science of monogamy. I said, listen, if I don't have a gene coding for a long vasopressin receptor, and I also maybe wasn't, there's a certain kind of psychological profile of the way you were raised that'll make you more sort of akin to monogamy. I'm like, if I have neither of those, should I even bother trying to be monogamous? And his answer was, first of all, I said, maybe I can get like a transplant.
Mm-hmm.
but there's no, for example, they've played with oxytocin, vasopressin on humans, and it might make you sort of feel a connection after sex or something, but won't make you kind of mate for life.
Well, there are actually, not to rabbit hole too much, but there's actually a lot of people using intranasal.
Mm-hmm. That's how they do
and
it.
And a topical oxytocin to enhance your feeling of connectivity or romanticism towards your partner.
Yep, and that's exactly what he was talking
about.
Which
I think you need a doctor's prescription for, I believe.
And that works in the short term, but not the long term.
Okay. So it's like a short-term.
And really, man, maybe you're with the wrong person if you have to do that. Let's just face it.
Like my concern, because I experimented before. I haven't used oxytocin.
Right.
When I went to Thailand last time, I bought a whole bunch of their like Thai version of Viagra because there's so much research on that for everything from sports performance enhancement to, of course, sex to, although those are the biggest two. And one thing I noticed was the couple of times that I used it for sex, I started to get nervous when I didn't use it about what would happen. Like if I'd still have it,
right.
Or if I needed that, I'd be concerned about oxytocin too. If you'd always need that little bottle of oxytocin in your pocket.
Right. And I think the fear or the worry is the same way sort of like heroin addicts, that it's sort of their body stops producing opiates because they're to kill the normal pains. They're like, oh, I'm already getting opiates. I don't need it. In the same way with your body right. lessen its own.
Yeah, so many negative feedback loops, even for right. topical or testosterone creams or progesterone in women, it shuts down, you know, endogenous production, which you may need to do short right. term.
I think let me ask, because I think yeah. the thing that I've really sort of learned since sort of we're in a world now, and your podcast is a good example of that, where you have to be your own expert, you have to be your own doctor, you have to be your own nutritionist. And what I found is, it isn't like most things are not good or bad. It depends on what you want them for. For example, mm-hmm. we were in the sauna having a discussion with Darren, who is an incredible writer and doing some great studies.
Oh, that guy who does supplement research, yeah. who was in the sauna at yeah. Laird and Gabby's. That was amazing.
He has a great book called Super Life.
Oh, he does have yeah. a book. Yeah. I didn't know this. We were picking his brain. And we'll get back to
but he was so there were all those recent studies about how coffee is good for you,
right?
And he was saying that coffee hurts your stem cells. So the thing is, it's not that something's good.
It can actually kill what he called totipotent stem cells.
Yeah.
So what this guy was saying was that we all have these totipotent stem cells that can be converted to any other cell, that they get released from connective tissue, but that if they are in the bloodstream and presented with oxidative damage from things that are even like mild hormetic stressors, like alcohol or coffee or things like this, it can actually shut down longevity. And he's doing a bunch of research on how, I believe what I understood from what he was saying was that 1-2 combo of injury or inflammation or excess stress combined with coffee or alcohol or anything else that we might consider to be these hormetic stressors that in small amounts are actually good for us, are bad for us and can kill stem cells if right. we're already stressed out or injured or inflamed.
Yeah, and I think the main thing that I've kind of learned is, well, everything has good and bad effects. It depends on what you want it for, and you really mm-hmm. have to know. So when you read something to decide this is good, well, what's it good for and what's it bad for? And you make those choices.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting what he was saying about stem cells too, that a lot of the stem cell stuff they're doing is just useless.
Those stem cells that you get injected from bone marrow or amniotic fluid right. or embryonic stem cells, they don't have the capability to differentiate into the same type of tissue that these totipotent stem cells we have in our own body can differentiate. Right.
Was that the first time we heard the word totipotent?
I've heard the word pluripotent before right. in reference to stem cells, but never totipotent.
Yeah, same. Your memory is so good that
you could possibly have made it up.
Right.
Because I was funny. In a sauna with no Google.
But I think he's pretty well connected.
Yeah, he was a very fascinating guy. And I asked him when we finished that discussion what his top two supplements that he would take for anything from like cognitive performance to anti-aging would be. And his response was not coffee, but coffee fruit,
right.
which is the combination of the coffee and the seed. And then not turmeric, but tumerones, which apparently are an extract of turmeric that are way different than like curcumin or right. curcuminoids or anything else, but they make anything that you take them along with extremely bioavailable. He said none of this stuff is available on the market right now, but coffee fruit extract and tumerones.
So we're going to have to
learn something new this morning.
Yeah. His main job is he's a superfood hunter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Super Life. I didn't know he had a book, but I'll, by the way, if you guys want in the show notes to access any of this stuff, you can find the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Neil, as in NEIL, bengreenfieldfitness.com/Neil.
And Darren, just so people know his last name too, it's Darren Olien, Olien is his
okay.
last name.
I'll hunt him down. He's kind of a beast too. He was killing the pool workout.
Yeah.
Okay, so you immerse yourself into this book. You wrote the truth, and to come full circle to what you were talking about regarding vasopressin and the volts.
So I just thought maybe this is not the way we're naturally meant to live. And so I started thinking maybe I should find the type of relationship that's natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I experimented with polyamory, with mm-hmm. open relationships, mm-hmm. with swinging, with maybe not having your sexual partner the same as your romantic bonding partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of tried everything.
Mm-hmm.
Things I tried living, I just thought wouldn't it be cool just to live in sort of a commune situation where everybody's sort of connected and relationship fluid and just living with a bunch of mm-hmm. friends in this freewheeling paradise. On the third day, somebody tried to kill me over jealousy with an axe.
Yeah.
So
the full story of that is in the book. It actually is a quite interesting book.
So what I learned was that when every one of these things went wrong or turned into some sort of disaster, that I had to kind of face up to the fact that it was my own emotional unhealthiness, and I brought it with me to whatever kind of relationship I was having.
So ultimately, what'd you find out in the end there?
So, yeah, what I found out was if you're unhealthy, all your relationships will be unhealthy. That's the first thing. But the second thing, like the big lesson, and I really would love to dive deeper into this if it is into the kind of the more hardcore psychology of it, but that your relationship has nothing to do with the other person. It's all about you and the way you relate to the other person. And basically, we have templates that are created by the way we're raised and the wiring, the way our brain is wired, that cause us to be in functional or dysfunctional relationships. And so, for example, if someone hasn't done the psychological work on themselves, and if they tell me the way they were raised, I can guess how their relationships are. If they tell me how their relationships are, I can tell the way they were raised. There's a like a one-to-one correspondence.
I remember when you and I first met, the very first thing you asked me was how my relationship with, I think you asked me about my relationship with my mom,
right?
If I remember correctly. I thought it was such an odd first question to ask someone who you've never met before.
Well, what I was curious about with you, and let's sort of discuss it here, is obviously there's a control issues with you around the way you live your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you really control what comes in, what comes out.
Strict, regimented, measure, type A.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's, and your extremeness in it is what is your talent, in a sense, and why your podcast is so great. And why I trust you that with that kind of information. But I also think that it comes as a response to something. So my question was, what was the environment you were raised in that led to that?
Yeah. And
what's the answer?
Yeah, so my environment was actually a relatively strict, controlled environment. You know, I was homeschooled K-12. I had a really good relationship with my parents, but it was also a very, very kind of strict upbringing. Some would say, like, you know, a sheltered, you know, stereotypical prairie muffin homeschooled type of upbringing.
But to figure this out, you almost have to go one level deeper, right? That's the sort of postcard version.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, like, and maybe one way to say it, like we can start here, which is, first of all, strict in what way?
It's okay. Anything goes on this podcast. You can delve deep and ask me embarrassing questions.
So we'll start. Let's go with that. 3-year, 11 or 12 year old, were you Ben? Benny? Or were you just little Ben? Benjamin?
Benjamin. If I was in trouble.
Right. If you're in trouble, you're Benjamin.
Yeah, right.
So give me 3 words as little Ben that describe, say, Dad, as you saw him through your eyes then.
At 12 years old? Quiet, in almost like a standoffish kind of way. He was not very physical, right? Like not a lot of like, you know, hugs or, you know, piggyback rides, stuff like that. That's something that also stood out to me. I know this sounds like I'm saying a bunch of bad things about my dad. I'm not, I'm just saying it how it is. And, you know, I guess one of the other things that comes to mind is that I didn't feel like I learned a lot from him, right? Like that's something I'm very careful with my kids is to teach them how to shave, how to fish, how to hunt, how to do what we might consider in our culture to be like manly things.
Right. And by the way, when we do this, I think the hardest barrier to people with their own personal psychological growth is the desire to protect one's parents from saying anything so-called bad.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially knowing that you know this is a podcast, right? It's going to be in public, and my dad might listen to it. So.
Right. And he might, and listen, it's not a relationship with anybody if you can't be honest with them.
Right,
right,
right.
And imagine if
it's actually
you can't
a really
have
good book about this. I just read called Radical Honesty.
Yeah, yeah, Brad Blanton.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. He's great. He's fascinating. Yeah. There's some great mini documentaries on him on YouTube. They're worth watching. And just to kind of press that point, what you want to think about these are they are the variables that make you you, and we're looking at them as variables non-judgmentally. Mm-hmm. In other words, all human beings are imperfect. Thus, all parents are imperfect, and some of those imperfections get passed on to you. But if you want to know your own the operating system you're running on.
Mm.
You have to do sort of this virus scan on yourself, and you do it by figuring out, well, what is the way I was raised? And if you look at it again, sort of, you know, scientifically, is, you know, you're born, you've got your brain, and the architecture of your brain is built in those first years, and they're being built at an astonishing rate. A three-year-old has twice as many neural connections as you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And then after three, while you're still learning, but a process called, there's that saying, cells that fire together wire together,
mm-hmm.
right? So as you're having these experiences that, whatever, dad is distant, and so I got to learn stuff for myself. So that's the first lesson is, okay, I'm not being taught from my dad. I have to learn it for myself. Guess what? All, we were talking about my books. I had the same kind of dad, exact same almost.
Really?
And so all of my books, if you think about them, are looking for these father figures. It was it was mystery in the game. In the truth, a lot of was Rick in a sense. In emergency, it was the survivalists. Mm-hmm. And looking to get those skills that I never got from my parents, right? And same with you. That's why you're so
I'm on a constant quest to find find those mentors, find those people who will teach me things, you know, go on adventures and discover and learn, usually from experts in their respected fields.
Right.
And, you know, it's a big part of what this podcast is about, right? Then bring that knowledge to the masses.
And that's the gift of the trauma and the gift of that upbringing. The hardest, there are some people probably listening right now that maybe the hardest person to see themselves in this way is, and this is the toughest, is when mom or dad, and often it was dad, when you live in a family where dad was always right or mom was always right, they were never wrong, and there was no arguing with them, because what happens is your parent takes almost, that's sort of God. It's mm-hmm. They call it spiritual abuse because the parent is God and they're never wrong and they're always right. And of course, even when they are wrong. And so as you get older, to question your family system is almost like blaspheming God. Mm-hmm. And those are the hardest people to get to sort of see themselves.
Mm.
And so to go full circle, when I talked to Hasi Wallin about monogamy, he said he always had
to the
geneticist.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Who did the study with guy. the and by the way, it's prairie voles and meadow voles.
Meadow voles.
The other kinds.
Good.
He said you get to change things at any point. You can change things. The older you get, the harder it is, because all those repetitions have really of that behavior have mm-hmm. really wired in those beliefs. But what I found was if you can shift your beliefs on a belief level, everything changes. A lot of people, for example, I'm going off on a small tangent, but a lot of people want to change their behavior. So they think, I want to quit this habit or start this habit, it should be easy enough to just do it, right? You make that choice. But if you can't do it, if your willpower is not enough, then you have to start looking at your beliefs, because your beliefs are what drive that. And they're harder to change than behaviors, but the reward is they shift everything.
Hmm. Interesting.
There's a model of NLP, which I love, and I always think about this for change and transformation. I realize I'm jumping.
Neuro-linguistic programming.
And this is the model for change. So on the outside, there's your environment. So I know so many people who think, I'm going to move to this place and have a new life, or I'm going to move to this place and I'll quit drugs.
Well, I personally believe that I believe the phrase goes to radically change your habits, you must radically change your environment. Isn't that a saying?
Yes, and I don't think that's true. So it's the shallowest, simplest way to change your habits. So the outside is environment. The second level is your behaviors. Mm-hmm. So, hey, maybe I'll start doing this and change the behaviors. So one deeper than behaviors is your capabilities, what you're capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the deeper you go, the more change radiates outward to the outer mm-hmm. layers. I wish I could draw this. Beneath capabilities are your beliefs. Beneath the belief. So the belief is, if you believe deep down, let's just say, sometimes someone whose father wasn't around, and let's say their mom was very critical, they might have the belief that I'm worthless, I'm not good enough, right? If I was good enough, dad would have cared for me and mom would have not been so negative. And so they'll take that belief that I'm not good enough to everything they do. And it can, the positive side is going to drive them to greatness. But the downside is they'll always be miserable because they just feel like, I'm not good enough, no mm-hmm. matter what they do and what mm-hmm. they perform with. So beneath beliefs is identity. Identity might be your way of being. Who are you? Are you joyful? Are you negative? Are you stressed? So your identity is just really who you are. And mm-hmm. any guesses what the deepest level is that shifts everything?
Below belief, below identity.
Yeah.
I don't. What would it be?
The deepest is spirituality.
Really?
So your belief about the entire world and the universe and what's the shift and structure is of the world, your kind of worldview is the deepest. That's why if somebody's going through AA or NA or, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous or something, it's all spiritual stuff, because if you make a spiritual shift in your spiritual beliefs, everything changes.
Interesting. Interesting. So what you're saying is that, you know, to kind of get to one of the things that you and I talked about before we even started recording this podcast, you know, we were talking about like smart drugs and nootropics and how to hack your brain without smart drugs. So in essence, if you want to change your brain or your mental function, are you saying that you start with looking at where you're at spiritually?
Here's where I would start. I would start with there are a few signs when you're out of touch with reality, and I'll give you those those signs. So one is, when do you overreact to things? So for example, an overreaction could be getting angry, right? You might get really angry at someone or something, but the truth is, like, really, did whatever they did or happened justify you being in a rage or anger out of control? Another form of overreaction is shutting down. Some people shut down. Another form of interaction is anxiety. You're in traffic, you have a ton of anxiety, but does it really matter? Is it worth the stress you're putting on your own system and your health because you're going to be a couple of minutes late to that thing? So whenever there's a saying where there's overreactivity, there's a wound. And that's usually attached to a false belief. And so the first thing is, I think you have to be to be a scientist of your own lows. So where are you overly stressed? Where are you overdepressed? Let's say you break up with somebody. And you're just devastated. The truth is, like, probably if you broke up, it was probably the right thing. And let's just say someone comes to you, and the worst thing that could happen, they say, you know what, I cheated on you, I'm in love with someone else. Right? Like, do you really want that person back? They made a choice, right? Mm-hmm. And you can respect that choice and move on and find someone that works for you. But that's not how it feels, because it triggers a deeper wound. I often find that heartbreak is sometimes the best motivator for change, because you're really in, like, a primal emotional pain. So when someone's sort of heartbreak is greater than the situation that happened, it's really not about them. It's about mom or dad. It's about that primal attachment wound.
Have you written about this in any of your books?
I think,
or is this all like neuro-linguistic programming?
No, everything I'm saying, by the way, we left neuro-linguistic programming was just those levels of change. That was all
okay.
Good. And this stuff is the stuff that's in the truth.
Okay.
So the stuff we're talking about is in there and in between the lines in there.
Okay, gotcha.
But I think if you start, so what is overreaction? Another one is this. Let me ask you, are all people equal? Are all people have equal worth and value as human beings? Do we all have equal worth and value as human beings?
Well, my gut response is yes.
Yes, of course we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, no matter who it is, whether the president or
somebody. I was wondering if you're asking me trick questions.
No, it wasn't a trick question. The truth is, we all have equal worth and value as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you feel less than others or better than others, that's a sign that you're out of alignment with reality, and that also comes from a core kind of wound.
Interesting.
And again, I'm kind of like going heavy without all of the context, but like understanding these concepts allowed me to sort of break in, and then I can say, okay, what's going on here? And the way I would sort of map it out for myself is, if I can figure out the core wound, the false belief. So, you know, I'm worthless, I'm not enough, you know, nobody understands me.
So that's step one, out the false belief.
Figure out the false belief. Next step two is figure out where it came from. Because you can figure out where it came from, you can let go of the lie. Are we going too, like, heavy without the context for it? Or no? Are we going to, like, getting too psychological without
context? I think we're okay. I think now that you're kind of, like, summarizing the steps, this is helpful for people who are out bicycling or running and listening in with smoke coming out their ears.
Here's a good example. When I was in rehab, there were people in rehab for exercise addiction. Right? There are people who are, you're doing it to be a healthier person, but some will do it to such an extreme that they're hurting themselves.
Right.
Right? That they're, like, poisoning their system with the wrong kinds or too much. You know,
anorexics, overtrained, inflamed exercisers, bodybuilders, people with like a body dysmorphic disorder or an obsession with the way their body looks, that type of thing.
And the thing is, it's not what you're doing. This is my philosophy. It's not what you're doing that makes you healthy or not healthy. It's why you're doing it. So are you doing it just because it feels good and it seems right? Like the pool workout, the truth is, I don't really know all the science of it. I know that I feel good mm-hmm. before, I mean, during yeah. and after, I feel good.
I usually feel hungry.
Yeah. I feel good and enjoy it. I just enjoy it. And so I moved to work. That's it. But if you're doing it to sort of compensate for an inadequacy, and also you look at your results reveal to you your intentions. So if you're doing something and it's making you less healthy, or your weight is getting worse, or you're depressed, or you're less
chronically
happy,
fatigued, overtrained,
right? Yeah. Then maybe you have to look at why you're doing it.
Right. That makes sense. So you
so it's doing that chart, right?
Delved away from the chart a little bit, but you identify.
So you identify the beliefs.
The beliefs, okay.
And it's crazy. Like, if you really start to think about it, your beliefs, really, really will just. I just see them just getting. I see so many people, and again, you know, my other job is for Rolling Stone. For 20 years, I've interviewed the most famous people in the world for Rolling Stone. That's kind of been my job.
Yeah.
And I see that, and I know I'm going off a small tangent, but I see that fame and money don't make people happier or fix anything. They just amplify what's wrong with them. So a lot of people quest for a certain goal, whether it's fame, maybe it's money, maybe it's health, maybe it's a certain weight, and then they get there. They achieve that goal. If you're lucky, you achieve that goal. Then you get to that goal, and this goes without exception. You get there, and you realize, oh, now what do I do? Because I'm still living with myself, and I'm still have the same emotions that I thought these things would
fix. Sure. You look at a guy like Robin Williams, might be a perfect example of that. Like, amazing guy who achieved a ton in life, and I think checked off most of anything that he wanted to check off in life, and by all extent or by external measures, he was rich and successful and funny and happy, and then he committed suicide.
Yeah, and a lot of people, and this go, I would say, almost with very few exceptions, they get there and they hit a depression as soon as they reach their goals. Because before, you could say, oh, I'm not happy because I'm not there yet. And then you're there.
You see this in the world of like obstacle racing and marathoning and Ironman triathlons and these type of things. People they'll cross the finish line. Mm-hmm. And then what you see is folks get really sad for a couple of weeks unless they have another race to sign up for or unless they have another event on the horizon.
And is that any different than a heroin addict? You need the next fix to feel good.
Not much. You know, right. Some would argue a healthy version of that, some an unhealthy version. But it's actually, you know, it's brilliant marketing on the part of, say, like Ironman Triathlon, because they open up registration the next morning, right? You got to go stand in line and register and write your $600 or $800 or $1,000 check or whatever it is now to get into the next race.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you have that meaning thrust back into your life.
That emptiness.
ASAP.
Exactly.
The emptiness is filled before you've had a chance to dive
back
into depression.
And that's the goal about the why. If you exist with your own meaning, then everything else is just great to do. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for a meaning outside yourself, you're just giving all your power away. Mm. So what it is you identify your core issue, then you identify where it comes from. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if I think I need to compete and win because at home I only got attention from my parents when I got good grades or excelled in this or that, or my brother got it because they excelled in this and that, and so I'm still competing for love, right? I'm competing for attention. I'm competing for my own validation. And once you identify where it comes from, you can let go of the lie. You can realize, oh, it comes from that experience. It's not really a truth. And then you can kind of, then the third thing is to replace it with the actual belief and the actual truth. So if the truth is, if you realize the false belief is like, I only feel worth and value when I have an accomplishment, the truth is I have worth and value, period, as a person.
Yeah.
And you can start sort of reparenting yourself.
Yeah.
And sort of being the parent and giving.
That's really interesting. I don't know if you run into this, if people give you this response a lot, but like for me, right, this strikes home what you're saying, right? Like, 'cause I'm a hard charging, you know, high achieving guy who's always looking for the next big thing that I want to accomplish, the next way to make myself better, the next, you know, rung of the ladder that I can climb. And what you're saying is one of the things that you'd recommend that I do is go back and look at what beliefs I might have about myself.
Right.
And then where those beliefs came from, and then generate a new belief that I actually am worthy and don't need to like do all these things to prove to the world that I can accomplish X or Y or Z.
Right. And a great example is that Michael Phelps, the swimmer, Michael Phelps, is that it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he just went through some of the same stuff that I went through. and went through a lot of rehab and stuff like that.
You mean sex addiction?
I don't know. I think it was sex. I think it was alcohol. I think it's all tied together.
I think he was weed.
Maybe it was weed. I don't know. But he kind of came out healthier and still killed. It didn't take away anything.
Yeah.
So the thing is, you can keep the benefit of it, and you can still strive toward excellence, but not keep the compulsiveness.
I don't know. There's still a lot of Michael Phelps memes out there that I think he ended up creating.
And again, like dealing with this, healing the stuff is like the half-life of radiation. Mm. You keep cutting in half and cutting in half, but there's a little bit that's always there.
Yeah.
But it's getting to the side where it's not compulsive anymore, where you're actually making the choices and you're in the driver's seat and these things aren't driving you.
This is really interesting. I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but it's very close to home.
Let's go to you and let's sort of discuss it a little bit. And give me the three words for mom, and then I'm going to ask some other questions. I got a feeling it comes from the...
Okay. So three words for mom at 11 or 12 years old?
Yeah, just around that age.
Mm. Okay. I would say that she was very protective.
Right.
Very protective of like everything, you know, how late we were out at night, what movies we were seeing. We had like even, you know, things like squawk boxes on the TV to keep us from hearing curse words and, you know, just like, you know, which was really funny because my brothers and I would study carefully the TV screen to figure out what they were saying and then go rush away to find out what that word meant. And
right,
I was like
funny.
Obsessed with cursing.
But you can probably read lips well now.
Like having the squawk box, made us into really good cursers. And what else? I guess when you ask this question, like, I personally start to think about flaws more than I start to think about...
Go with what you think about. Yeah. I think it's hard.
Right.
I think us having this conversation in private might be slightly different.
Sitting at your dining room table in front of microphones.
Knowing that but again, like, I think maybe the truth comes out. You guys can have cool dialogue.
Right? Oh, yeah. No, I know that.
So
know,
protective.
Stuff like this gets back to my mom and dad. That's of no concern to me. They know I'm a pretty honest guy. Sometimes too honest. So the...
I'll argue that there's no such thing as too honest.
radical honesty, right. Overprotected or overprotective. I would say... what else? She was very busy. Busy all the time.
Right,
like always
busy.
People had to be over. Always something had to be going on. Always there had to be a conversation. There wasn't a lot of silence, right? There wasn't a lot of like, you know, stillness, meditation, you know, and I've had to overcome, I think, at times my own propensity to go stir crazy, you know, when there is silence. I've actually gotten very good at, I've used things like hunting and meditation and, you know, all sorts of methods to get better at just being alone in my own thoughts.
Yet you're still you're still busy meditating
hunting. You're still hunting.
Because I think that's that message from there is like, it's a doing philosophy versus shifting to being philosophy.
Right. And then I'd have to say, gosh, what would be the last thing? Tough to say, man. So a little bit overprotected, very busy, and I would say she was extremely involved in our lives, right? Like driving us here.
It's funny to say the one you really want to say because you feel like, oh, I got to end with a positive one, but say the one you really want to say because I can see you. I'm sitting here watching you, and I'm watching I'm watching you think, oh, I really should end with something positive.
Right, exactly.
But I'll tell you, we'll still
okay,
go to those.
Okay, so almost there to almost like an annoying extent.
Right, right? Very present.
Like we had to have pagers when we drive around so she could page us and communicate with us, and now... You know, even still, it's just like boatloads of text messages and things like that. And
right.
So extremely, extremely communicative, perhaps to a flaw.
Right. So, so the pattern for you, and which is funny because it's the same for me, is abandonment on the dad side. And again, what people think abandonment is dad is not there. Abandonment is sometimes when someone's not sort of just, you know, emotionally, physically present with you. They can be present. Like a friend of mine, her dad's a famous... executive, let's say, in Hollywood, and I was always really working hard. It's a great loving dad, but because he's never around, she always chooses guys who are not available, no matter what. She's always with guys, and if a guy's available, she just doesn't feel any chemistry or connection because she needs that unavailability to feel that connection, which is why she's amazing and it's just so hard for her to be, find a relationship that works. So
an unavailable guy, like a married man or something like that.
Or usually it's emotionally unavailable. Okay, it won't be a married, gotcha. Abusive guy who like is flat, you know, might not return phone calls, disappears after a couple times of hanging right. out and, right. you know, just is like, okay, let's make plans, but doesn't really commit to a plan. And she gets stuck on that. Where she meets a loving, present guy, and she's like, oh, you know, I don't feel any chemistry with him. Well, of course you don't, because that's not your template. So you have a sort of abandonment on dad's side and then enmeshment on mom's side. And a lot of people don't know this concept, but it's the opposite abandonment. So abandonment is the parents not, is some sort of neglect, the parents not physically mm-hmm. or emotionally there. And you kind of know it's, an enmeshment is, that the parent, in your case, is there too much. But the idea is this. The job of a functional parent is to be there for the needs of the child. And those needs include, it's not taking care of all their wants, but to be there, then child's needs comes first. In the case of your mom, some of her strictness was not for your needs to make you sort of the best person possible, they're for her needs, about A, what she thought you should be, and about her not feeling anxiety because she doesn't know where you are. And so enmeshment is, you're in a sense serving the parent's needs. This can come if for some people, they become mom or dad's therapist, or daddy's little girl, or mom's kind of surrogate boyfriend. It doesn't, in where she's sort of having all the emotional conversations with you that she should be having with her husband. Or sometimes someone has a depressed mom who they're always trying to cheer up and you're there for their needs. So a lot of your mom's strictness was really about her needs, not about yours. So that's the word for that is enmeshment. There's an engulfment is another word that's used for it. And so it's a pattern a lot of people don't know. And it tends to, the result, and this isn't true, I mean, you've been married for a long time, but it tends to make people avoidant sometimes in relationships because if someone's too needy, I assume your wife's not a needy person.
No, my wife's like freaking independent.
And that's
crazy. Like I just called my wife from right. your patio. It's the first time I've talked to her in a week.
Right.
And I... Like, she doesn't text me or call me or anything when I'm out traveling. Right. Like, she's super independent. She just
knows
to the grindstone, does her thing.
It works.
Yeah.
Because if she needed to check in all the time, you would go nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'd go nuts.
Yeah.
Right? Because, and someone who was sort of raised with that enmeshment, they might get in a relationship and someone's really needy and they'll just feel their skin crawling.
It's really interesting. My wife is like one of the least communicative people when it comes to constantly being in touch.
Right.
And like very few texts, very, like she could lose her phone for a week and not care.
Right.
And, you know, whereas I would be, you know, searching up and down and using, you know, locate my phone on iCloud and
right.
You know, so yeah.
What was her relationship with her dad? Her dad and her
are really close.
Of course they are, because she is probably enmeshed in some way with her dad, and that's why she's a little avoidant too. So you're like kind of two avoidants together, and it works really nicely, in a way.
Interesting.
It's interesting, right?
It's really interesting.
It really is like the map of your psyche, and once you start to understand that, then you can realize, okay, what's working for me, what isn't working for me. You can start to do the work to change it. It's fascinating. Like, we're really running on these operating systems that were programmed in the first 17 years.
Yeah. To hammer this home for folks, the three steps again are?
I think the steps are identify the beliefs that don't serve you.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out their origin. So those are your core beliefs. Then figure out what this origin story of them is.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of replace them with the new beliefs that are true, right? Yeah. Because most of our beliefs are total lies. And you'll see it, if you start to think about it, you'll start to see it happen, you know, all the time in your life. You're out and you're like, oh, you know, I feel like people don't feel like I fit in, or I don't feel like I did good enough. And you'll start to realize the other thing that's related to is your family message. So with you, and it's fun, but we're not trying to psychoanalyze. What we're doing is giving this as an example so other people can think about themselves.
Right.
So every family has a message that's spoken or implicit. And for example, in my family, I used to think the message was, you know, do great and be successful, but the actual message was, don't fail, don't screw it up. Everything I did, they were always scared something was going to go wrong or something was going to happen. Mm. And that's maybe what led me maybe to the game, in a sense, was I was trying to find out the science so I wouldn't get rejected in, you know, meeting women, right? You know, I figured there's a right way to do everything. I don't want to fail.
Yeah.
I even have this group called The Society, which is this sort of 100-person mastermind group.
Yeah.
And the motto is,
how you and I met. I think you a society meeting at an anti-aging conference anti-aging institute.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where the whole focus is on longevity.
Yep. That was it. Yeah. And the motto is, you only live once, don't blow it. Hmm. In a way, that's my family
message. That's the motto of your entire society. You only live once.
And I only realized afterward that, shoot, I just took my family message into that. So what's your family message?
I don't know if I could put it into it as succinct. You, my family now, like...
Oh,
like
no, back to growing up.
Just me and River and Taryn, or me growing up?
And all that matters for the stuff we're talking about is the first 17 years.
I think, you know what, to me, it would be centered around something like... have you ever seen that cartoon online called The Greenfields?
I might have.
Okay. Well, I forget.
Is it like an old newspaper cartoon with like a family?
It was one of the very first like online animated cartoons.
Really? My brother called The Greenfields? Is it after you?
Well, I remember my brothers and I used to just like howl at it because there was like Nana Hooter, this big, huge, like a woman in it with these giant hooters she'd injure people with her hooters. theme for that show was, "We are the Greenfields, the mighty, mighty Greenfields." And it goes on. I don't remember the rest of it. But it was very much like that, where we were supposed to be the Greenfields, like the proud, mighty,
right. So the message
high achieving, like, so the message leaders.
Is we are the Greenfields, and I haven't seen that, but the message is, we are the Greenfields and we are the best.
Very, very unique snowflakes and the
best. Right.
Yes.
Which
that was the message. Yeah.
Which is exactly how you live your life.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
You know
the most.
Right.
You exceed in all in the you know, Spartan races and everything, and that's how you live your life. That's, you're living out that message.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating, right?
Yeah.
It's like we're programmed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
And one of my main, the things I do the most is interview, right? I've done that for Rolling Stone, the New York Times. That's really been my job. And what it is because my mom would kind of come into my room when I was really young and tell me about all the problems in her life and with my dad and stuff. And so I learned to have sort of an empathy for problems that I really, in life that I couldn't really understand. And that sort of set that up, that sort of model to be stepping in other people's worlds and understanding them and explaining them. It's fascinating, right?
It's super fascinating. You have written other books. We were just in your library. You've got lots and lots of books that you've written. One turned my head, and it's actually on way up there on my list of books to read. Your list of books to read is longer than my list of books to read, by the way.
Right.
You have a section on your shelf that's what, maybe there's 30 on there that you want to read? I think mine might be 7 or 8 right now, and growing. Do you have the same problem where people just send you books out of the blue?
They do, but it doesn't mean I'm going to read those.
It doesn't mean I'm going to read them.
But they get in the way of what I want to read.
The way I'm wired is if it shows up and it's there, I kind of want to read it. I'll start to thumb through it. And then it's why I don't watch many movies, is I can't start them and not finish them. Finish the story.
Oh, I'm the same way. My wife hates that about me, but it's true. If I start a movie, even if it's bad, I need to make it to the end.
Yep,
and but I'm a finisher.
Totally sucks.
If I start... Like, I just finished this article for Rolling Stone about fear, about the psychology and biology of fear, because it's obviously a big thing in our nation right now with the election, and you see politicians, advertisers, other people exploiting fear. A lot of it's about how we make bad decisions around fear, but it was such a big article to write about fear for Rolling Stone, also to step into the political kind of war happening in our culture right now, that I wanted to give up 1,000 times. I really wanted to write my editor and say, this isn't for me, I'm not doing this. And I just push through and push through and push through, and then you get to a point where you do it and you're so happy you did it and it's great. But I'm like you, I'm not a quitter. I don't give up on stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a finisher, but even of the really bad movies.
Yeah. You have a lot of books in there to finish. I do want to ask you, though, because you're such a prolific author. And again, like I mentioned, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Neil, N-E-I-L, I'll link to all of Neil's books. I would like to ask you, and I didn't forewarn you that I would ask you this question. I want to hear a few stories from your books. You have a book called... The Dirt, is that correct?
Right.
That you wrote when you were following
Motley Crue,
the band, around, just following them around the world on tour.
Right.
What was one of the craziest things that happened in writing that book, or one of the most memorable aspects of that book's creation that perhaps you you haven't shared or that you'd like to share?
Well, I mean, I guess let's consider the subject matter is Motley Crue. So we're not going to be going. We're going to not be going to be going very deep here.
Mm-hmm.
And my
we're not going to be talking about health,
right? Right. I mean, my interest in Motley Crue was this was before the game, and these guys just seemed to be living the most decadent lifestyle ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wanted to tour them and see what that was like. And I remember I was doing an article for them for a magazine, and that's how I met them. And we're gonna get adult here. So. I mean, not in the language, but in the visuals. The themes,
iTunes likes themes, to call it explicit,
mature themes. So I remember they were sitting around, and this isn't the best story. But this is what made me decide I want to write the book. I was a different person back then, and I think Tommy said, you know, remember that time that we were offered like $20 for any mother daughter that did the band, and then Nikki Six was like, yeah, but you know, then we started going broke because we were spending so much money, and then Vince goes, and then we decided to do it. Any mother-daughter grandmother does the band, and Tommy did it. And they would sit around telling these insane stories.
Does the band, like screwed a band member.
Right.
Mother.
It was for mother-daughter, and that was happening so much. They did mother-daughter grandmother. And they were sitting around just telling these stories and like just nonstop. Or remember, like, we used to just kind of rent Ferraris and then crash them to the wall and rent another Ferrari. And like they just, it's almost like, here's the thing. If you're this is the opposite of the philosophy that you just shared about about radical personal responsibility in a sense and the way we're responsible for ourselves. What happens if you're sort of a rock star, specifically mm-hmm. more music than film? In film, you got to get jobs and people have to like you for you to get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
In rock star, your job is to be a rock star and all these people around to just babysit you, to get you drugs, to put you on stage, to get you. I mean, I remember I was backstage and someone. On the microphone, oh, we're going to get too crude. I'm not going to say what they said. But they basically were on the walkie-talkie, and they said, we need this specific sexual act for the boss, and that was sort of brought in for them. And so basically, like, it's an eternal hall pass to be an adolescent. And so there's no responsibility.
When you're
get away
a rock
with anything.
Star.
And as long as you show up on stage, you're okay. I remember,
would you say that rock stars are getting healthier, though? Like I'm just curious, for you being a journalist for the Rolling Stones, running into a lot of these guys.
I'll tell you what,
like,
aging rock stars start to realize the toll they put on their bodies and get healthier, but that not all rock bands, by the way. I've mm-hmm. toured, so here, you know, I've toured, say, with Beck or somebody, and he lives a very healthy, you mm-hmm. know, lifestyle, and they watch, not, I wouldn't say very healthy, but they watch movies. It's hard to stay healthy on the road in a rock world. I was touring with a really healthy band, and they mm-hmm. still couldn't do the healthy stuff because there's just soda, chips everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere you backstage. Go. It's so hard to stay healthy on the road. But some people do it, but they'll travel with their own cook.
I was going to say, you need to prepare in advance and take a lot of these meal replacement blends.
It's really hard. I mean, roadies, like the average life of a lifespan of a roadie is like 50, 55, you know, at the most. You die soon. It's sad. Yeah, I mean, that's but I remember the point that you were, I remember once, my first book was with Marilyn Manson, and I remember I was at his house one night, and he called
and
up.
What was that book?
The Long Hard Road Out of Hell.
Long Hard Road Out of Hell.
And he called up his manager. He says, "Oh, I want to set the mannequin on fire and push it in the pool. Is that okay?" And he's like, manager's just like, "Sure, do whatever you want." But literally, like, it's just stupid human tricks all day. They're just bored, and a lot of them get into drugs, often because people on the road want to connect with them, or they're just bored and they start doing drugs. So, I guess I've been in a lot of worlds. So that's
you have been in a lot of worlds. You wrote Don't Try This at Home with Dave Navarro, How to Make Love Like a Porn Star, where you followed around a porn star, Jenna Jameson.
Right.
You wrote The Game, probably one of your more famous books, Penetrating the Secret Society of Pickup Artists, How to Make Money Like a Porn Star, Rules of the Game, and then one that I think our audience might find pretty interesting and one that I'd like to hear your take on, Emergency. Yeah. This book will save your life. The book with the picture on the front is like the fire, the thing that you pull down to...
Yeah, the fire alarm.
To break the fire hydrant open, or to break the case for the fire hydrant open. Emergency. What's
it's like
about?
The emergency pole.
It's like urban escape and...
Or what it's about
invasion?
Is this. So the world we're living, or so I kind of thought, in a scary... It seemed to me like we're living in a scary world, right? First of all, since 9/11... We live in a world where there are terror alerts every day. What's the terror alert today? What color is it?
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, after 9/11 changed the psyche of our nation and myself, because all of a sudden you realize people on our soil could be here and try to hurt us. Then I remember I saw Hurricane Katrina, and I realized, oh, our government really can't protect it when there are bodies floating in the streets in New Orleans, you realize, Ken, our government is not can't protect us from a natural disaster, and they're not going to be able to rescue you. And so I started studying disasters and survival and preparedness. And literally, if you talk to the fire department, the police department, they say if there is a disaster, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. You're on your own. Like, they're going to be putting out the big fire, the big problem. They're not going to be able to deal with it. 911 is going to be...
The random person walking through the street looking for water is not going to be...
Yeah, exactly. Or a broken leg or a concussion. You know, like, that's not any... Or shot. It's not going to... Their system's going to be overloaded, and they're trying to deal with the bigger stuff.
They're going to be off fighting the zombies or the attacking helicopters.
Yeah, and maybe if the whole system's not broken down, maybe 3 days later they'll get to you. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the first most basic thing that I learned is really if you don't have... you know, a stockpile for at least 2 weeks. Like, you're stupid. I just call a lot of people stupid. It's just really have enough food, water.
No, it makes sense. I'm shocked when I walk into some people. So, and I'm a total prepper, right? Like, I have guns, gold, silver, and people are going to be Googling me to find out my address now.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, if crap hits the fan, I could survive for quite some time.
Yeah, I'll show you my garage after
2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. And get, if you just, but just have two, like, just have at least 2 weeks for the system to get back online, mm-hmm. at the minimum. You know, you can go as far as Ben and I if you want to kind of next level it. So what I did was, and it goes back to the father thing, is I didn't have a father who took me, say, hunting, like, or taught me how to make a fire or do anything, change a tire, anything practical. And so I sort of just started learning how to be self-sufficient, how to survive, kind of like you do at your mm-hmm. place, how to survive off the grid. And, and I remember,
and
even
in an urban scenario.
Even in an urban scenario. So it ranged from, one thing was, I think when you can survive for 3 days to a week in the wilderness with nothing but your clothes and a knife on your back. Your clothes on your back and a knife, not in your back, a knife in your, and a knife in your back.
That would be hard to do. Clothes at your side.
Exactly. You have no fear anymore. Mm-hmm. If you lose all your money, you're going to be okay. You can survive. You know, you can live off the land. It's an amazing feeling to have. It's not just physical. It's really some emotional security. And then on the urban survival, and you've hung out with Kevin Reeve and the On Point Tactical people.
Yeah, On Point Tactical. I'm actually planning on doing one of their 3-day urban escape and evasion courses up in Seattle.
Great. And they have some great advanced one, or the kind of first level?
I think I'm signing up for the advanced one just because I want to go straight into the fire pan.
They're both great. I would do them both. So what they teach... is because the truth is a lot of the wilderness survival is we're not really living, most of us, in the wilderness anymore. We're living in an urban or suburban or rural environment, but it's not all nature. We have, you know, corrugated metal, and we have all these other things.
Finding mushrooms in the forest might not be as important to you as figuring out a way to scale barbed wire.
Yeah, exactly. Or how do you break into that place that has food?
Right.
So really, if everyone's abandoned the area, so they teach you lockpicking.
Mm-hmm.
They teach you... how to escape from handcuffs, how to escape from, how to get over barbed wire, how to, what for one of the tests, you're handcuffed, put in the trunk, they drive over a bumpy road or whatever, and you have to bop out of the handcuffs and escape from the trunk.
You did this. They threw you in the trunk, handcuffed.
Yeah, you run with leg irons. You learn it all. Yeah, and there are a lot of people there who are actually military, who are maybe going over to Iraq or Syria or back then Afghanistan. And they might be caught behind enemy lines.
Is this also the course where they will attempt to chase you through the streets and kidnap you and you have to evade them?
The final exam, you are handcuffed and zip tied to some of your classmates. You're driven off to the middle of nowhere, and then you're let out. So you have to escape. You have to run a mission, but they're bounty hunters looking for you throughout the city, and you have to sort of evade them. And I did like a very psychological trick, which was so you go out in pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized they're going to be looking for pairs of people. So I got onto social media and I said, hey, I need 5 people to hang out with me. So I hung out in a group because I knew, like, visually they're looking for pairs. If they see 5 people, they're not going to think they're not their students.
Smart.
So that's how I kind of made the evading
social
body
media.
Well, you're allowed to prepare in advance.
Oh, okay.
And what they're preparing was it's creating a cache. I have caches, by the way, like 3 of them in LA. A cache is where you bury your supplies, right?
Wow. So before you do this course, you can go prep anything you want.
Yeah, you can go prep. So like bury some caches and supplies.
In LA, where you buried supplies?
Yeah, I still have caches. Yeah.
And you know what? There's like random parks and stuff.
Yeah, different locations. I got one on Catalina Island.
That's crazy. Yeah. So it's a good idea.
I actually hid a cache, and no one's found it yet. There are clues in the illustrations in the book to find the cache. And
really?
I hid one and gave people clues to find it, and no one's found it yet.
When I called you on the phone the other day, I think on your voicemail,
yes, there's a hint.
You said that had to do with that.
There's a hint. Yeah, my number is hidden in the book as well.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
And by the way, this book that we're talking about, just so you know, it's probably going to be the one that I would say might appeal the most to the folks listening in, because we've got a lot of adventurers and people who want to take on a challenge. But at the same time, we delved into some kind of deep stuff too, and I think that's important. We went to some places I didn't expect that we were going to go. But this other book, The Truth, also really interesting.
And maybe it's only because I just wrote it and it feels like part of my soul in a book. It's the emergency, the stuff we're talking about. By the way, take this course, read that book, but like doing that deep work on yourself will change everything. It can give you that winning edge. A lot of people don't succeed in life because they have an inward fear of failure or a fear of success. Some people are actually afraid of success because they feel like they're not worthy or they won't know what to do or just is something they haven't experienced. We have these limiting beliefs that really screw up our lives and our relationships and cause self-sabotage.
So if you've learned anything from this show and you're listening in, it is to go bury stuff in the woods near your house.
That's exactly the message.
It is to
make sure you mark it though on a GPS,
right,
or something.
Exactly. Get yourself an Oculus Rift and also carry dumbbells back and forth across the bottom of the pool. And then
that's my family
also,
message.
Identify your limiting beliefs. Identify your limiting beliefs and identify your new belief.
Yeah, be a scientist of your own lows.
Yeah, be a scientist of your own what?
Lows, your low points.
A scientist of your own lows. Interesting. And that is how to hack your brain without smart drugs.
And so much more.
I like it. All right, cool. Well, Neil, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, it went to some interesting places.
It did. And if you're listening, again, you can grab the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Neil, N-E-I-L. And until next time, I'm Ben Greenfield here with Neil Strauss, signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have a healthy week.
Cool.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.